This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations.
Hello, everybody. My name is Yacid Ortega. This is Chasing Encounters. Today, we are recording in the park again. Our season number 4, episode number 1. Today we're gonna move away a little bit from the topics that we are used to related to education, but it will eventually be connected to education towards the end, because I want to bring people to this podcast that can sort of steer us away from the regular conversations. But the focus, as always, Chasing Encounters, is about the diversity of people, the diversity of knowledges, the identities that people are bringing on board, and sometimes languages and cultures, and definitely everything in between. So today we have a person, PhD student from the Department of Geography and Planning at the University of Toronto here in Canada, because sometimes people don't know that we're in Canada. People think that we are somewhere else. But anyways, just a reminder that this podcast is being recorded in Toronto, Canada, and actually, as we speak, we are in next to the University of Toronto campus, right, like the Queen's Park. So, Jean-Paul Matias, right?
Yeah,
that's your name.
Matias in Spanish,
right?
Because I'm originally from Mexico City. I can get into that in a little bit.
Yeah.
And here, Matthias.
So. Oh, that's see, those are the topics that I would like to discuss in a moment. So obviously, Jean-Paul Matias, I'm going to say Matias for now, and then because that's probably easier for me. But you also go by JP. How do you like people to call you JP or Jean-Paul or Paul?
I guess a lot of different people call me by different names, sometimes right. John, sometimes Paul, sometimes Jean-Paul. But I prefer JP.
Right.
Ever since I was a kid, my dad referred to me as JP. Mm. His name's John. So I guess it's a way to differentiate his name from mine.
Yeah,
so,
that makes totally sense.
So I like JP, and in Spanish it would be JP.
Oh, really?
So I know people in Mexico who call me JP also.
Right.
So I guess I like it. It's simple.
Right, right. Just so people know, JP or JP is a Canadian-Mexican, I would say, Canadian, right? You were born in Canada?
No, I was born in Mexico. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, Canadian-Mexican is a good way of putting
okay,
it.
Okay,
yeah.
So Canadian-Mexican or Mexican-Canadian. Now, it's a good question. How do people put these things together, right? And those binaries that we tend to put together, like, why do we have to label ourselves either other way, right? You know?
I was just thinking about that today, because I was thinking about talking about my family maybe a little bit. And yeah, like, I guess I'm a Canadian Mexican in the conventional way of things, like in the US, how they say Mexican American or Italian American,
right.
You know, putting the ancestry before the nationality,
oh,
I guess.
Shoot.
So I guess in that sense, yeah, I'm Mexican, sorry, Canadian Mexican.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't see myself as either.
Right.
I guess.
Right. No, definitely. Sometimes we are neither from here nor there, like a little bit in between. And that's why this podcast is about those identities, who we are in relation to our experiences, right?
Yeah.
So let's start a little bit about you and your family. Let us a little bit about your father and your mother. Where are they from and your relationship with them, really quick?
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, I was born in Mexico City. My mother is from Mexico City also. Her family's from Mexico from generations past. And my father is from Canada, specifically Hamilton. He was born an hour away from here.
Right.
But he grew up in Windsor, Ontario, which is on the border with the U.S., with Detroit. So I guess in that sense, since my father... there's like a bit of an international identity in the sense that my father worked in Detroit while living in Canada. And my father and my mother met each other in Mexico City, because my father was, so he worked for Chrysler Motor Company. And he was in Mexico for like a six 6-month term. He met my mother through Spanish language classes, and I guess they hit it off. and yeah, they got married like 2 years after meeting, right. Something like that. Nice, and then nice. Like a year after I was born in Mexico right. City. Lived there for the first few years of my life. Then my father got a job offer, same company, in Etobicoke, so in Toronto. So we moved, when I was around 5 years old, we moved to Canada, we moved to Burlington. And I lived in Burlington, so I grew up in Burlington, lived there for about 5 years, from the ages of 5 to 10. Mm-hmm. And I learned to speak English. That's another thing, I'm bilingual, but I don't know if I'm a... So you know how they talk about English as a second language,
yeah.
or as a first language, or Spanish as a first language. So I don't know if I have a first language.
Your first language is both languages.
I would say first language is Spanish, because that's what I first heard when mm-hmm. I was born. Mm-hmm. And of course, I don't remember it, but first heard and first practiced as a very small child. But I also learned to speak English as a very young child. So. Yeah. Yeah, I that's another thing about like first languages, right?
Right.
And then we moved back to Mexico. Another job offer my father got, and basically lived most of my life there from the ages of 10 to around 30, more or
right.
less. So that's a bit of my background.
That's interesting. Yeah. I always like to talk about the family first, because I think it is important to always sort of start thinking about where we are coming from and our roots, our heritage. You were talking about the language, right? And for us who are experts in language education, we always talk about these binaries. Am I Spanish speaker, English speaker, or both? And because now recently we are talking about the idea of plurilingualism, or mm-hmm. a plurilingual person is this person who has knowledges of different languages and they use them whenever they are necessary. So by that definition, we are plurilingual. You are a plurilingual person. You don't have to be defined by either or these things, but just this person who has these languages. And I think that's important. Anyways, moving on to your research and the work that you have been doing, or before entering into that, I understand that you studied your master's degree at the University of Toronto as well.
Yes.
Tell us briefly a little bit about what was that master's work.
So before coming to Toronto to do my master's work, I studied international relations at the Universidad Iberoamericana in Mexico City, mm-hmm. which is a Jesuit school, private Jesuit school.
Right.
And I guess I was always interested in international relations because of my position between two countries.
Right.
And also, I guess how I came to live in Mexico, and how, because of the growing economic ties between Canada and Mexico and Canada, I mean, sorry, in the U.S. and Mexico, that kind of led my father to live in Mexico.
Right, right.
So I was very interested in these international processes, because that's part of my identity. That's basically how my parents met and
right.
how I was born.
Right.
So I studied international relations. I was always interested in these subjects, but I was also very interested in working with communities and working with NGOs in the NGO sector. Basically because I guess I had this experience seeing the differences between Canadian society and Mexican society. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was never comfortable, or never... I don't know, there was something about the way that we were taught about, you know, these ideas of underdevelopment development and how there's underdeveloped countries.
Interesting.
And there's developed countries, mm-hmm. Mexico being in mm-hmm. the former... Canada and the latter, and I guess I was always curious, and always I just didn't buy a lot of the narratives mm-hmm. that were told about both countries in this sense,
right.
and the wider world in general.
Right.
And studying international relations also helped me to understand the political processes, that create these conditions where some countries are quote-unquote poor countries, mm-hmm, have less, at least people within those countries have less access to material goods, basic needs, basic services, and other countries there's I guess less of there's more access to these resources. And this is also why I was interested in working with NGOs, with on the ground organizing and communities. So that led me to work with a government funded program. It's an educational program that that was put in place around 2010. And basically what we did was we went to high schools or junior highs, they call them secundarias in Mexico, in areas that were deemed, I guess you could say, violent or dangerous. This is during the war on drugs.
Okay.
This is during the time when President Felipe Calderón declared war on the cartels,
yeah,
and
imagine,
on drugs and violence in general. At least the indicators just spiked, and there was a lot of violence, a lot of disappearances, and so what this program attempted to do was we made workshops for teenagers, for young adults, to question, in this case, gender relations, gender roles.
Right.
So there is this issue or this preoccupation about how gender roles play a critical role in violence in Mexico and in Latin America in general. So what we tried to do with these workshops was trying to question, like, why do you think a man should act in this way, or should do this type of work, or should do, you know, why do you define, what defines a man, and why does it,
right,
why is it defined in this narrow, right, concept? So we worked a lot with masculinities, actually, because a lot of previous work was done with a feminist, it was a feminist perspective, but more on the gender roles of women.
Yes.
And what this project tried to I guess, tackle with was the masculinities part, because
right.
really very few people were talking about masculinities and trying to question, well, what pressures do men, or what pressures do boys have in terms of acting in a certain way,
right,
or reproducing certain, in many cases, violent forms of relating to people. And basically we tried to, with these workshops, try to question that and try to maybe change their perspective on what being a man is, or being a
especially
woman,
especially in
is.
Mexico. Yeah?
Yes, because and I think Mexico, Latin America in general, there are, I mean, it's different everywhere. There's also issues with gender roles here, but in Mexico there is this, at least from my experience, a kind of strict way of, a narrow way of seeing what a man is supposed to be,
right,
what a woman is supposed to be.
True.
And we try to question that to attend to the violence that was occurring amongst young people,
right,
in marginalized communities and in cities that were experiencing high levels of homicides, high levels of cartel-related violence.
Right.
So that was a good experience. I really enjoyed that. I got to meet a lot of great young people, a lot of great kids. And coming from a privileged background, it also helped me, I guess, question my own prejudices.
Right.
My own way of imagining these communities and imagining these places as marginalized, as inherently violent.
Right.
And actually having experience with these children, with these teenagers, you realize that, I mean, a lot of this is created by the media. A lot of this is created by the dominant narratives that we have about these places. And really, they're just kids who want to have a good life, you know? Want to have friends, want to, you know, be able to provide for their families in the future. Like, we would ask them questions about what you want to do when you grow up, what you know, stuff like that. And, you know, it helped me also question my own prejudices.
Right. No, interesting.
Yeah. So from there, I got more interested in community work, got more interested. So I guess I started questioning also my own formation,
right,
in terms of international relations is very institutional. Mm. It's very much geared towards studying international institutions, state institutions, political formations, like on a broad, looking at the broad scale.
Right.
But with this work, I guess I started to get more interested in what's going on the ground.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that led me to participate with, for instance, the Movement for Justice and Peace, for Justice with Peace and Dignity, which emerged in 2011.
Right.
This was led by the poet Javier Sicilia. His son was murdered by cartel members. Mm. So he started a movement for victims of violence in Mexico. And I was very much involved in that, and I guess I just, my interest grew in movements and in, right, and social and civil society, and see how things are occurring on the ground, not just looking at yes, it from a, you know, from a broad perspective, but right, actually looking at it in real life, you could say.
That's so interesting, yeah, because something that I found interesting in the work that you have described now is your high interest in community, like you said, on the ground, like grassroots communities, you know, and then the idea of challenging all the time what we mean by being developed or in developed, underdeveloped countries, and then questioning all of those things are so important that I assume that part of that questioning or self-inquiry sort of translated into the work that you are bringing into the PhD, which our listeners don't know yet. But Jean-Paul is working on the concept and ideas of water in relation to communities as well in Mexico, right?
Yes.
So I like that when I was interested in talking to you about this topic is because in this podcast we have not necessarily talked about this issue, the idea of land, water, and indigenous people in Mexico. So I think my first question is, what got you interested, like moving from these community sort of work with the NGOs, now moving into the field of like geography and water and land and indigenous peoples in Mexico?
So when I was looking for a PhD after, I didn't even mention my master's. So
that was even before the master.
So after working with this government funded program,
right,
I worked for the National Institute of Statistics. Mm. I was there for about 2 years. It was a good job. I mean, I published a few books on government statistics, analysis on stuff like number of bureaucrats in each municipality. Superficial stuff about how government works in Mexico and different indicators around that. But I guess I was left unsatisfied with my work. Mm. I always wanted to go back to school, to go to grad school and kind of, I guess, expand my horizons, you could say, in terms of understanding social processes and understanding why certain inequalities exist in this case in Mexico in particular, in Mexico City, which is where I'm from. Mm. So I decided on the University of Toronto because they have a good political science department. Mm. And within that department, there's a stream which is critical development. Mm. So it's actually called Political Economy of International Development.
Right.
So I was always interested in development, like I mentioned before. I was interested in development because of these narratives of underdeveloped, developed, what it takes to become a developed country. And I always questioned the idea that so-called underdeveloped countries, in order to become developed, they had to follow in the steps of developed or northern countries such as Canada or the US, which I always found contradictory in many respects. Mm. These countries are so-called developed because of the exploitation that they've I guess that they have been able to gain wealth through exploitation of other countries and of other territories and of people within the territories that they control.
True.
So I went into that stream in my master's. My research was focused on the emergence of social movements and civil society in Mexico City.
Right.
From the 1980s onwards. My focus was on this period from the 1980s to the present because it coincides with what many now call the neoliberal era or the neoliberal turn. Which is when a lot of state functions and a lot of the state resources that went to communities and that went to create, I guess, a form of state welfare started to disappear, or the state started to retrench. And there was a vacuum left in terms of people not having access to resources that were previously given by the state. So within this vacuum, social movements emerged demanding rights to basic needs, rights to water among them, and also NGOs and civil society. And I also started to see this divergence between social movements that emerged on the ground from a grassroots perspective in marginalized or poor communities. And on the other hand, NGOs and civil society that emerged among more middle class, upper class parts of society, which I mean, it's not. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but there is this idea that civil society is all of these actors, and in reality, there is a divergence between even a class. You could say division between NGOs and social movements.
There are the poor NGOs and the rich NGOs.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I get it.
So I started seeing that. I started being interested in water specifically because Mexico City. There's a big issue with water in terms of water scarcity. When I was living there, there was also, you would always see on the news every once in a while how eventually Mexico City is going to run out of water. All this discourse around water scarcity and around the idea that we have to take care of water, and also putting, I guess, the onus or the blame on individuals for not taking care of water, basically. You know, like, oh, you didn't shut off the tap, or
it's your fault.
You're using water to clean your house instead of, you know, using a broom or whatever. When in reality, if there is a lack of water, it's also over exploitation of the aquifers from industry, from other powerful actors who have way more access to water than regular residents whose water use is much lower than large-scale transnational companies or even the state. So a lot of social movements emerged demanding a right to water, a human right to water.
Yes.
There is a historical... There is, I guess, a lineage of movements that have been demanding a right to water within the city, and that got me interested. And also, so geography is a good way for understanding also social-spatial difference. So how space is created through social processes, through economic processes, but basically how space is shaped by state action, by our own actions. And water, for me, is a good way of exploring those differences within the city.
Right.
And also for exploring why certain social movements within certain areas of the city that are deemed, I guess, marginal, that are deemed impoverished, emerge with different demands than NGOs and civil society in other areas of the city that were looking to, I guess, provide water for all, but through a more privatized approach. So privatizing water, you know, with this discourse on efficiency, with a discourse on private industry is the best way to provide water for all because it's more efficient and because it'll charge everyone, and charging water for everyone will make you, I guess, a responsible user. So personal responsibility was a main aspect of the discourse used by NGOs in one sector, while social movements in other parts of the city were demanding access to water. They're basically
free water, I have to pay.
Of course, it's a human, it's a human right.
Right.
And that really got me interested in seeing this divergence and in exploring how water and water flows, mm-hmm. how they have been constituted along lines of difference. So along class lines, along racial lines, along gender lines, and how those intersections are manifested in space, basically in certain neighborhoods, in certain areas of the city, and how those also create imaginaries about the city and that, about, I guess, who deserves water and who doesn't.
And who deserves water for what you've seen? Well, what is the narrative? Who deserves
the narrative? Okay, so the hegemonic narrative, I guess in a broad sense, would be that people who deserve water are responsible users, and people or companies also, not just people, but like entities, organizations, who will use the water efficiently and who will use the water for productive means, being agriculture, industry. Right. So water is in this sense commodified. It becomes it becomes a commodity that can be traded on the market.
Right.
And as such, it should be put to productive use.
Right. Right.
And users, water users who do not undertake these forms of water use, so-called efficient forms and productive forms, are deemed less worthy of having access to water. There's also the idea of, so you probably know this being from Colombia and it's very prevalent in Latin America, but informal settlements around the city that don't, in the beginning they don't have access to water because they're constructed quote unquote informally. So they don't have access to the main water pipes, the main water infrastructure, and they have to gain access through private vendors who sell them water at exorbitant prices. But many of these residents have been living there for years, decades.
Yes.
And they still don't have access to water, partly because they're deemed not worthy.
Not worthy. Who's thinking like this? Who's saying you are not worthy of this because you won't be able to use this water properly? Is it the government, companies, private companies?
So that's what I'm very interested in. That's a complicated question.
I imagine it's not an easy.
It's a big question. There really is no one, so you can't really pin the blame on one institution or on one person. It really is. So I guess part of my research, what I'm interested in, is how this conjecture of imaginaries about water in place, about race in place, about who lives in certain places, and what how we imagine the people who live in these places, how all these different elements and different forms come together to create these, I guess, assemblages where there's an unequal access of water. So partly it's the state. The state is very much involved in deciding who gets water, who gets water use. I should mention that water is controlled by the Mexican state in the sense that the Constitution declares that all waters within the national territory belong to the state, and the state has a faculty of giving concessions of water use or water access to whomever the state wants.
Like a company who wants to exploit the water and make bottles of water and sell them.
Yeah, so before 1992, all water was owned by the state and was seen as public. So only the state could provide use or access to water. After 1992, which was a big year for, I guess, for the neoliberal turn, because a lot of reforms were done to the Constitution that permitted the privatization, in this case, of water, and also the privatization of communal agricultural lands known as ejidos. So in the case of water, what changed was that the state was now able to give concessions to private actors, private companies, but also private people, you know, not just companies, but like whoever the state wanted. And to gain these concessions, you have to go through a bunch of hurdles, bureaucratic hurdles. I mean, companies are able to obtain these concessions because they have the necessary resources to go through the whole administrative process of obtaining them, while municipalities and small communities do not have those resources and do not have access to government officials that can grant them access to water. So that's the state part. So the state decides who gains water use and who gains access to water. But it's also the media. It's also the media in the sense of how the media portrays certain areas of the country, certain areas of the city. I don't know if you know this, but media is very much centralized and monopolized. Well, it's an oligopoly, you could say, in terms of television, in terms of mostly television, but also some newspapers, some other written media. And the narratives that they construct also play a role in who gains access to water and who gains access to material, other material resources, food, land, etc. So I'm also interested in seeing how media narratives, dominant hegemonic narratives, also influence decision making and policy making. And also, I guess, and this is where hopefully eventually, because with the current context of COVID and the pandemic, I was hoping to do ethnographic research in Mexico City in areas where there's a lack of access to water. So my interest was also to see on the ground how water inequalities are produced, and how community actors and state actors and NGOs, how they all come together, and basically how water inequality is reproduced, and also how it's contested, and how communities organize to contest the current status quo and to change it and to actually gain access to water.
But it got me thinking how all of this is affecting the indigenous people, because I understand you're going to be working, or you're working in Xochimilco, right?
Yeah.
Area. And then how is this affecting the indigenous people?
So I got interested in Xochimilco because Xochimilco is very relevant in terms of water for Mexico City for many reasons. I guess a very basic reason is that a lot of the fresh water that goes to the central city comes from Xochimilco. So Mexico City, basically, there's an aquifer that's right under the city. And a lot of the water that is extracted from that aquifer is extracted in Xochimilco. Xochimilco is also the part of the city where a lacustrine environment, meaning what's left of the once vast lakes that occupied the Valley of Mexico basin. This is one of the last areas where lacustrine environment is situated. It's an area that's full of canals. It's an area where there's small lakes also, and also an area where communities practice a form of agriculture called chinampería, or chinampas. And these chinampas are basically, they're like man-made islands that are created with the vegetation from the surrounding lacustrine environment. So it's like aquatic vegetation. And they're also filled in with soil, and the irrigation is done by the canals that surround these islands. And this form of agriculture has been practiced since for at least a millennia. So before the Europeans arrived in Mexico, this form of agriculture has been practiced, continues to be practiced, and actually provides a lot, if not most, of the foodstuffs and most of the crops that goes to Mexico City's markets.
All right.
So a lot of the food that we eat from Mexico City's main markets comes from Xochimilco.
Right.
And has historically come from Xochimilco.
Right.
And this also includes water. So how it's affecting them is that through the over-exploitation of the aquifer in Xochimilco, many parts of Xochimilco are drying out. And communities there are having to deal with a desiccation of their environment.
Right.
Also, they have to deal with the contamination of their waters that they use. And what interests me about Xochimilco also is this very strong indigenous identity, presence. So in Xochimilco, there are these towns, indigenous towns, that are called Pueblos Originarios. So another contest, Pueblos Originarios, is also, I guess, a shorthand for indigenous or indigeneity.
Right.
But these are recognized officially in law as Pueblos,
quote-unquote
Pueblos Originarios.
Right.
And what this means is that their forms of governance, of choosing their community leaders, of also undertaking religious festivities, of their social reproduction, basically, are based on tradition, are based on their own customary laws. And it was only until very recently that the City of Mexico government has recognized those traditional forms of governance as legitimate forms of governance before the state.
Right.
And what interests me is how those forms of governance relate to water and how their forms of governance is very different in understanding our relationship with nature, our relationship with water, than those that have been practiced or have been put in practice by the Mexico City government and the Mexican state in general, which, like I mentioned before, are more geared towards productive means, geared towards commodification of water.
Right.
So there is this contradiction in terms of how Pueblos Originarios view water, treat water, and how it is essential for their social reproduction, because they undertake their agricultural production through Chinampería, which very much relies on the existence of this body of water, of the maintenance of this body of water. So I'm also interested in how indigeneity relates to water in this sense. So why is it that water is extracted from these places? And why is it that this water that is extracted from these places goes to the central city areas? So there's also this idea of who has access to that water, and why is water... So why is the people that live in the central city areas, why do they have more access to water that is actually in Xochimilco, and people who actually live in Xochimilco, in these communities and other surrounding communities, they don't have adequate access to it when they actually live where the aquifer is located.
Man, so interesting. You know what? All of these conversations got me thinking that at least for our listeners, what do you think, based on the work that you have done, both working with the communities, the NGOs, the knowledge that you have about the government, the knowledge that you have shared about capitalism, the industrialization, and how all of this affects communities, how would you think, or why do you think, is water so important? In your own words, like if we step back a little bit from the research point of view, is why is water so important?
Well, I think water is, because it's you could say it's the most basic need for life.
Right.
Not just for human beings, but for life in general. I mean, obviously there's oxygen, there's the sun, etc. But like water is the most basic need, and it's I guess it's a good way to understand inequalities in that sense, because it's the most basic need. And for me, and from what I've seen, and my interest in seeing the materiality of inequalities, it shows where inequality or how inequality works, and how how certain human beings are deemed less worthy simply because they have less access to water.
And
in this way it kind of becomes a vicious cycle. So they don't have access to water, so why is that? Oh, because they don't they don't deserve it, and it becomes a vicious cycle in the sense because the problem doesn't get fixed. They just continue to lack access to such a basic need, and the need that many of us don't even think about, you know, like especially here in Canada where we have access to tap water, we can drink directly from the tap. That's something that in Mexico we cannot do. Most people have to buy bottled water because tap water is not safe. Many people in the central city area, especially middle class people, water is just a given. You don't really have to worry about maybe having to wake up at 5 in the morning, 3 in the morning to line up to actually gain access to water. While other people have to do this, and it revolves around, like, basically they have to organize their life around getting such a basic need. So for me, it's just it's one of the most basic needs for life. And the way that water flows also shows where power relations, how power relations work. So the unevenness of power relations can be seen in the way that water flows, in this case in Mexico City, how water is extracted from one area which is deemed more traditional, more quote-unquote backwards, more quote-unquote primitive, to areas that are more quote-unquote developed, that are going to use it for productive means. And just by looking at those flows, you can see those power relations actually being enacted on the ground. And another thing that's interesting is also wastewater. The flow of wastewater is the opposite. So wastewater from the central city area, from industrial areas, from the factories, a lot of that wastewater flows to indigenous communities and flows to Xochimilco. Yeah. And people there use it for agriculture, for growing their crops. But it's also led to diseases, so cholera outbreaks and other types of diseases in the area, which has also translated in cholera outbreaks and other disease outbreaks in Mexico City's markets, because a lot of the food, like I mentioned, that's produced in Xochimilco goes to these markets. So it ends up affecting the majority of the population. Also, a lot of the wastewater goes to other indigenous communities outside of Mexico. So it's this way of, so you deserve the wastewater.
Yeah.
So the water that you have access as an indigenous community to is wastewater. While the water, the fresh water that is located where you live, that we're going to extract and we're going to take it to areas
and we'll give you the wastewater back.
And we'll give you the wastewater
in return.
Back. Exactly. So for me, that really shows how power relations are undertaking in the material sense. And geography really helps me understand how space is produced in that sense and how the city is also imagined. So if these abject realities that people have to go through, I mean, if they're actually produced materially, and other people go to these areas and see, oh, they don't have access to water. Oh, they don't have access to sanitation. They don't have, you know, it also creates this imaginary of parts of the city that are marginalized, that are, you know, that are crime-ridden. So there's a stigma that just keeps feeding itself through these policies and through these imaginaries.
Yeah, no, very interesting conversation today. Something that I can take away from this conversation today, especially me that I am in the field of education or educational research, that I was just thinking, how can or what can education learn from this conversation is we need to learn where things are coming from or not, number one, and number two, to problematize and question where things are coming from or not coming from, like why is that some people have water and why others don't have water. And this is a basic thing that sometimes we don't necessarily think, like you mentioned, like we have access to the tap water every day. You get up in the morning, get some water, drink it and go.
Yeah.
But then we don't stop to think that there are other communities out there anywhere else, right, that they don't have this precious water, right? And then we don't think about it. So from the educational point of view, teachers and educators can bring this knowledge to their students to ask questions about the daily lives. As simple thing as you get up in the morning, get water, you have privilege. Others don't have this. And then the work that you do is sort of to help us understand all of these things and the relationship with the government and the relationship with the politics and the relationship. I always come back to the idea of capitalism and neoliberalism, yeah, and how these narratives of capitalism and neoliberalism are just decided for some, but not others. I mean, not everybody. Just for some, yeah, water is going to be for these people only because they really know how to manage the water. They really know how to do it. And the other ones, they're not going to get it. So I think at the end of the day, the work that you do is important for us in education to start thinking about daily things and things that happen on every day and things that are important, such as water. So, Jean-Paul, we're about to finish in a couple of minutes, but I want you to let us know if there is anything extra that you want our audience to take away from the research that you're doing or that you hope to do in the near future.
Well, I really liked how you summed up the importance of knowing, in this particular case, where water comes from, water inequalities. And also, because my research is also interested in indigeneity, mm-hmm, and how indigeneity is constructed, co-constituted through material inequalities, mm-hmm, and how these social relations kind of feed off of each other. I would like listeners, especially listeners in Canada, to also pay attention to water inequality within Canada also, yeah, and how so many Indigenous communities in Northern Canada and Northern Ontario, despite being what many say is the country with the most fresh water or the most access to water, many of these communities, if not most, I'm not familiarized, but I know that many of these communities do not have access to drinking water.
And
have to boil their water every day, have to think about collecting their water every day, when, as we mentioned, we don't really have to think about it. So I would encourage people to maybe think about, well, where does my water come from? Where does my food come from? The mass production agricultural goods that goes to the supermarket, how that's affecting our lives, how we have access to that food, and there's other parts of the world that don't have access, mm-hmm, to that food. So just thinking about the material realities that surround us, and which is, in this case with water, what I'm really interested in, to explore how they're related to our identities, how they're related to our position and to our privileges, and to not just take things for granted, to question, well, why am I in this position, and how come I have access to water, or maybe not, maybe there's listeners who don't have access, and to question that this is not natural, this has been naturalized, but there's processes behind them that create these material realities. It doesn't have to be this way.
Right. No, it's interesting because this podcast is being listened in the whole world. Like, I have the statistics, and then we have people from Africa, from Japan, from Turkey, like Switzerland, Australia, you know, Peru, Ecuador, elsewhere. So the good thing about this conversation is that this knowledge that you have brought today, yes, definitely we in Canada, we need to pay attention to that, but it also helps us to question these simple things. So I invite the audience, whatever you guys are listening today, it's about questioning and start asking this idea of, where is my water coming from? Where is my food coming from? Or why is that I don't have water and the others, they do have water?
Yes.
And ask questions to your friends, relatives, ask questions to your teachers, to teachers, to all educators, to anybody else, because the more questions we ask, well, we don't know if we're going to get the answer, but at least that's a good start. So, Jean-Paul, thank you so much for coming today to the podcast. I really appreciate to enlighten us a little bit more about these important issues for society.
No, thank you. It was my pleasure, and best of luck for the coming episodes.
Yes. Right on. Okay. Thank you so much. This is Yacid Ortega. This is Chasing Encounters. See you guys next time.